This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's gone. You better learn your past, you better learn your young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Good evening. This is part two of Morals, Morality, and Moralizing, involving the conflict, the confusion surrounding universalism versus particularism. And tonight I have two examples to talk about that I said I would talk about tonight the last time. These are recent headlines, recent items from the news. And one's more obscure than the other, but I think they're both very instructive. The first one is concerns Christians and being lectured, being moralized to by a Jew. This comes from a link that a friend sent via email. It's from an online magazine called Religion Dispatches. That describes itself as a mix of expert opinion, in-depth reporting, and provocative updates from the intersection of religion, politics, and culture. And so, morals and politics, as I said in part one, they are intertwined. I'm surprised they don't mention history there as well. I looked at the editors and advisors of this magazine, and there's lots of Jewish names there. So it's not a purely Jewish organization, but it's full of Jews. And the fellow who wrote the article that I'm going to quote here is, I would guess, is a Jew, because he's described as Adam Gregerman, the Jewish scholar in residence at the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies in Baltimore. The title of his piece is Theology Fail in Christian Statement on Israel, Judaism, Palestine. So it's a criticism of Christians. In fact, it's a critique of another paper. He links it. I'm not going to get too much into the details of what's in it, called A Call to Action, A U.S. Response to Kairos Palestine. So this is itself a Christian theological critique of the state of Israel and the Jewish religious beliefs that supposedly, according to Gregerman, buttress its policies. So he's making a critique of a critique. And I'm going to read some parts of this, and I'm going to make some comments about it, point out the conflict here between universalism and particularism. This is important, he says, it's important because the authors that he's criticizing come from major Protestant denominations, and he says these Christian traditions have, in a remarkable break with centuries of hateful teachings, opposed both Christian hostility toward Judaism and polemics about Jews' unfaithfulness to God. They also endorse a two-state solution to the conflict. So he starts off there with a bit of a backhanded compliment, saying that these Christians on the surface seem like good Christians from his point of view, because they're breaking with this 2,000 years of oppression against Jews that I mentioned in the last installment, talking about blood libel. That's what he's Gregerman is indirectly referring to here. And the two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the preferred solution, I think, of most Jews, because that means that the Palestinians will have their own separate state, and the Jews won't have to share their state in a single state solution. You know, of course, the United States, if we were to say that in the United States, that, hey, the Jews should get South Florida and share it with the Cubans, and you know, we'll take the rest of the country, and the Mexicans maybe can have Texas and parts of California. That's a horrible, horrible racist thing to say, according to Jews, because it's, you know, white people acting as if they have white interests in mind and that other people are not them. And, of course, we should think in those terms, but the Jews are constantly lecturing us that we're bad people if we do. When it comes to Jews with Israel, they make no bones about the fact that they're thinking about Jews first and foremost and entirely. It's worth saying twice here, quoting him twice, when he talks about centuries of hateful teachings and Christian hostility toward Judaism. Very, very one-sided, as I mentioned in the last installment, the reading of history there, the Jewish narrative of history, is that it's always the Christians oppressing the Jews, that Jews never did anything wrong, they're completely innocent. And, or did I skip ahead here? That's right. There's a second paragraph then right after what he said there about the Christian hostility toward Judaism. In their advocacy for the Palestinian cause, however, the Kairos USA authors have rolled back the clock. In its critique of Israeli policies, the statement troublingly undermines these positive Christian views and takes a zero-sum attitude toward the conflict. Out of a reasonable desire to support the Palestinians, they jeopardize these remarkable interreligious gains by issuing one-sided indictments and by failing to honor Jewish religious and historical perspectives. So what Gregerman's grievance is here is that these Christians are supposedly being one-sided. They're being anti-Jewish, according to him. And he's, of course, inverting reality. He's being one-sided in favor of Jews. He's making some weasel statements here that make it sound like he's being open-minded. You know, things about the reasonable desire to support Palestinians. He doesn't think it's reasonable. When you read his total thing, he ends up condemning these people. He doesn't think that they're reasonable at all. You know, this is just in the opening paragraphs here that he wants it to look like he's being fair to them. He isn't. He's being one-sided himself, and he's projecting that onto them, accusing them of being one-sided. These tremendous or remarkable interreligious gains are one-sided gains for Jews, that Jews have gained, and concessions made by Christians to Jews. That's what's at jeopardy here if these Christians are allowed to criticize Israelis. So what's the meat of the criticism that the Christians were making? Well, they made, according to Gregerman, explicitly religious a religious argument that worked in only one direction. Here's that theme again, you know, that it's so one-sided, you know, against Jews and Israel. It's not the criticism itself, but this inconsistent application of religious standards that's problematic, according to Gregerman. But the contradictions don't end there. Jews are also accused of both betraying the good, i.e. universalistic demands of their own Bible, and of heeding its bad, i.e. particularist elements. The Christian authors bemoan traditions in the Hebrew Bible that supposedly evince exclusivism and hostility to outsiders, such as the biblical promise of land that, quote, elevates one people or one race over another, unquote. Likewise, what they call theologies, quote, that privilege one nation with political entitlements to the exclusion of others, unquote, are to them also unacceptably particularistic. It is therefore wrong to prefer these parts of Scripture, and specifically to neglect universalistic themes about God's love for all humanity. In constructing a dichotomy between particularism and universalism, however, they also privilege some biblical themes over others, meaning the Christian critics of Israel are privileging some biblical themes over the other. So this is the nut of his objection, is that these Christians, and here you see, he puts it in terms of universalism versus particularism, these Christians don't understand. You know, they're confused about this universalism, which they value highest, and they don't like the particularism that they see in Jews. And what this Jewish author, Gregerman, is criticizing them for is not shutting their mouths and looking the other way while the Jews practice their particularism in violation of this universalism that they, in their own Bible, that they handed to the Christians, preach themselves for Christians. And they want Christians to be universalists while they themselves are particularists. So that's where the contradiction is. It's coming from the Jews, really, who want particularism for themselves and then want Christians to be universalist and to accept Jews having their own separate identity and having their own separate ethnostate in Israel, where they do elevate their own race over others. The Christians are confused. They think that's a bad thing. You're not supposed to do that. You know, from everything we're told here in the United States, we're not supposed to do that. That's racist. And so another mistake that these Christians are doing is, you know, basically they're thinking of Jews as white people. And this Jew, Gregerman, is saying, hey, you're wrong. He's expressing moral outrage. You know, the Christians are expressing their moral outrage that that these Jews in Israel are going against what they think are universal morals and the right way of thinking. And this Jewish fellow Gregerman is expressing his moral outrage. And it's really he has a hard time doing it because he has to make this complicated inverted argument, you know, flipping reality upside down, that it's somehow these Christians that are being one-sided in their argument when he's being at least as one-sided in his counter-argument. Failing to honor Christian religious and historical perspectives. You know, he makes the accusation that they're not respecting Jewish historical perspectives, but, you know, the case is just as strong in the opposite direction. He's not respecting them either, or their Christian sensibilities. And you don't need to construct a dichotomy between particularism and universalism. They are opposites to each other, literally opposites. It's really only in this Jewish doublethink that they're supposed to have to coexist peacefully. You know, that's what Jews want Christians to think, is that, you know, you've got to live by universalism, you Christians, and you've got to accept everybody into your communities and make them safe for us particularists to live in. You know, while meanwhile, we will stick to our particularism because we're better than you. So it's, you know, the Jews, as I said in the last installment, the Christians, I mean, are confused about this inconsistency, and it's really the Jews themselves who demand this inconsistency, and then demand that nobody ask any questions about this inconsistency. And if you do ask questions about it or express any confusion about it, you know, you're wrong, according to them. So I'll quote more here from Gregerman toward the end of his piece. He says, to illustrate the problems within Israeli policies, the authors gather historical examples of unprecedented brutality as parallels. These extreme examples not only foreclose constructive dialogue, but in some cases sever Jews' connections to their own history. For example, the authors look to antiquity, a time of tragic Jewish subjugation when Jews suffered from under, quote, imperial rule, unquote, and faced threats to their, quote, economic survival and physical health, unquote. Yet they, well, let me stop right there and on that paragraph make a comment. What he's talking about there is the blood libel, this business about, you know, Jewish suffering and Jewish subjugation. And don't these authors know that this is a purely Jewish thing? They're not supposed to cite this as if it's a general lesson, or that there's any universalist lessons to be learned from this. This is a very particularist Jewish moralizing that this narrative of history is intended to for. But he goes on. Let me continue to quote him now. This is Gregerman talking about these Christian criticizing these Christians. Yet they then cast modern Jews as the ones now responsible for such actions. In a stark reversal, Jews are cast as foreign imperialists and persecutors, he's talking about in Israel, and Palestinians as persecuted Jews. Oh my God, you know, that's what he's so upset about, what he's morally outraged about, is this inversion of reality that he says the Christians are doing. So let me continue. Rather than simply critiquing Israel's policies, some of which undoubtedly cause serious harm to Palestinians, the authors read Jews out of their own experiences, using centuries of murderous oppression of Jews as a model for condemning Israel's actions is highly disproportionate, as is invoking Jews' suffering to then use it against them. So what he's saying here is that you can't use Jewish moralizing against the Jews. You can't hold Jews to the morals that they hold everybody else to. It's ridiculous. It's, you know, from a universalist point of view or from a particularist point of view. If you're a universalist, these Jews are preaching that they get to tell other people what's right and what's wrong based on their history of oppression. And nobody else can take any lesson from that. And God forbid they should turn it around and say, hey, you Jews, you know, you talk about oppressing other people, but look what you're doing to the Palestinians in Israel. So this is not the only place you can find this. This may be a relatively obscure op-ed or opinion piece here in an obscure journal, but this is actually very mainstream. This is exactly how Jews argue about criticism of Israel. They do not want to hear their own moralizing turned back against themselves. Some of the most dreadful acts in human history, including those in which Jews suffered terribly. I mean, he just keeps going on and on about Jewish suffering. That seems to be all he cares about. This guy, in three paragraphs, literally says Jews suffering three times. The Crusades, the Spanish Inquisitions, here's the litany of white sins, genocides and ethnic cleansing. In these events, the statement notes, people used scripture to elevate one people or race over another. So the Christians basically took to heart what the Jews have been lecturing them about, and they see Jews violating these principles, and so they're upset about it. Let me cut it off there because I want to get to the second example. Let me just say that, you know, basically it's very similar to the Jewish Palin blood libel chimp out. This guy, the moral of Gregerman's story here and his critique is that it's bad or wrong or evil, he's moralizing, to subject Jews to the same moralizing they subject everyone else to. So let me move on to the second example here. The second example is taken from recent news in Germany. Germany recently passed some sort of a law banning circumcision, and lots of Jews have written op-eds about it, condemning the Germans for horrible anti-Semitism, and this is the next... This is not like another Holocaust. It's really stunning. It's very much like the blood libel thing, maybe spread out over more time and across over several continents. This one Jewish fellow, though, in the Huffington Post posted a piece titled Chief Rabbi Lord Sachs. I guess that's important because that's the author, and his name is right in the title. And he titled his piece, Europe's New Anti-Semitism. So there's the blood libel against Europeans right there, you know, that Europeans, not Germans, Europeans are anti-Semites, are anti-Jewish. And he talks about a meeting. He starts off by relating the story about a meeting he had in 2007, him and a small group of religious leaders. I wonder if they were all Jews, in EU headquarters in Brussels, with what he describes as the three most significant leaders of Europe: Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor and at the time President of the European Council, José Manuel Barroso, President of the European Commission, and Hans-Gert Pottering, who is President of the European Parliament. So you might wonder, you know, how does a guy like this get such a private meeting? But whatever, that's a measure of Jewish power and influence that he did have such a meeting. And what did he discuss at this meeting? Well, he says that, I'll start quoting here, concerned at the return of anti-Semitism to Europe within living memory of the Holocaust, I decided that the time had come to break protocol and speak plainly, even bluntly. I gave the shortest speech of my life. Sitting directly opposite the three leaders, I said this. Now, who's the leader, really? I mean, he's dictating to them. He's going to dictate. He's going to do some moralizing here. He's going to tell them what the score is, these supposed leaders of Europe. Quote, Jews and Europe go back a long way. The experience of Jews in Europe has added several words to the human vocabulary, words like expulsion, public disputation, forced conversion, inquisition, auto de fe, blood libel, ghetto, and pogrom. Without even mentioning the word Holocaust, that is the past. My concern is with the future. Today, the Jews of Europe are asking whether there is a future for Jews in Europe, and that should concern you, the leaders of Europe. It took less than a minute, and after it, there was a shocked silence. We adjourned for lunch, and over it, Angela Merkel asked, quote, "What would you like me to do, Chief Rabbi?" unquote. I did not have an easy answer for her then. I do now. Let me stop right there and say how amazing this is. Jews definitely have, and this one in particular, has a skill with language. And, you know, he talks about adding several words to the human vocabulary. Well, it's Jews adding these words. This and hammering them home as part of their guilt trip of us. This here he goes into it again, this libel against Europeans that we just have been bad to Jews for centuries, millennia even, and that we should feel guilty about that and just give them what they want. And he gets right to it. His short little speech is all about that. It's about what the Jews want. They're worried about their future in Europe, and they want to know what these leaders are going to do about it. And in fact, you know, Angela Merkel, according to him, at least, was very affected by this, was moved by this to say, okay, tell me what I should do, Rabbi. This is outrageous that they have this sort of say over what happens in Europe. And, you know, Europe for the Europeans, Germany for Germans, England for the English, France for the French. These Jews, they don't consider themselves Europeans. They consider Europeans the other. They're people who victimized them for 2,000 years. So why should Europeans have listened to what they have to say? But they put it in this moralizing language, making it sound like we're your moral superiors because you have mistreated us. And it works. There's no doubt about that. It gets them the effects that they want. So what he ends up saying is, well, I know now. He didn't know back then. He was so worried about the Jewish future in Europe, but he couldn't think of anything specific to say. Well, now he knows in 2012, he finally has something to complain about, and that is this Cologne court disallowing circumcision, male circumcision. And as I said, this is not the only Jew that's upset about this, but this guy is Chief Rabbi Lord Sachs. He's very, very important. But, you know, I get the impression he's not German or doesn't live in Germany. So I don't know, you know, why anyone gives him the moral authority to speak to Germans, tell them what to do. I'm going to skip over a little bit here because I don't really have time to talk about it. But the section I'm skipping over, I'd encourage you to read the whole thing. It's really, really outrageous. And he really just drives home this point of how Jews think of themselves as the other, you know, accusing Europeans of thinking of Jews as the other. I mean, Jews think of the Europeans as the other. It's definitely a two-way street there, although the history, as he tells it, is very one-sided. It's all anti-European. I have argued for some years that an assault on Jewish life always needs justification by the highest source of authority in the culture at any given age. Throughout the Middle Ages, the highest authority in Europe was the Church. Hence, anti-Semitism took the form of Christian anti-Judaism. In the post-Enlightenment Europe of 19th century, the highest authority was no longer the Church. Instead, it was science. Now, he's talking there, post-Enlightenment Europe is after the emancipation of the Jews. As religion lost its influence and science gained influence, the Age of Reason, the Jews really lost their fig leaf there as a separate people, as a religion, and Europeans started to wake up to these strange people. What are these strange people doing here? You know, before the story was, hey, they're Jews, and since we're Christians, we need to tolerate them, because they wrote our Bible for us. But as the religion, the fig leaf started to fall away, this is when the Jewish question came into existence, for people who want to understand about the origins of the Jewish questions. And the question was, who are these people? What are they doing in Europe? What do we do with them? But of course, from a Jewish point of view, this is all evil, 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 evil thoughts that Europeans had. And they're not allowed to think of the Jews as the other, even though the Jews think of the Europeans as the other. In the post-Enlightenment Europe, in post-Enlightenment Europe in the 19th century, the highest authority was no longer the church, instead it was science. Thus was born racial anti-Semitism, based on two disciplines regarded as science in their day: the, quote, scientific study of race, unquote, and the social Darwinism of Herbert Spencer and Ernst Haeckel. Today we know that both of these were pseudosciences, but in their day they were endorsed by some of the leading figures of the age. Well, you know, I think the denial of race is a pseudo science. It's not even science, but it's the suppression of science for political reasons, and specifically to benefit Jews, because Jews don't want to be identified as different, not just in the way they think and their religion, but in genetically, biologically different. Since Hiroshima and the Holocaust, science no longer holds its pristine place as the highest moral authority. Instead, that role is taken by human rights. It follows that any assault on Jewish life, on Jews or Judaism or the Jewish state, must be cast in the language of human rights. So let me stop there and note, this guy, all he cares about is Jews. Jews, Jews, Jews. Jewish life, Jews, Judaism, Jewish state. That's all he cares about. And he sees human rights being used as an attack on that. That's what he's talking about here. This whole several paragraphs is how Europeans have attacked Jews throughout time. Hence the by now routine accusation that Israel has committed the five cardinal sins against human rights: racism, apartheid, ethnic cleansing, attempted genocide, and crimes against humanity. This is not because the people making these accusations seriously believe them. Some do, some don't. It is because this is the only form in which an assault on Jews can be stated today. This is a lot like what Gregorman said. You know, this is basically these things, these words that were added to our vocabulary, this moralizing that's been planted in our heads, was planted there by Jews. And what this guy, this chief rabbi, is upset about is it being applied to Jews now. He doesn't want it applied to Jews because Jews are special. Jews need to be exempt from that. They meant that to be aimed at Europeans, and they never meant it to be aimed at Jews. So I've gone on too long. There's a lot here to talk about, but I'll cut it off there. And please read both of these articles. I think it's very instructive for white people to see just how disingenuous and deceptive and the doublethink that these Jews are pushing when they moralize and when they lecture us, and how they invert reality. And these are great examples. So I hope you enjoyed the discussion of these examples, and join me next time when I hopefully have something more to talk about. See you next time.